Hello, I'm Andrew Scrivani.
And I'm Chef John. Welcome to the Chef John Podcast.
Hello, and welcome back to the Chef John Podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Chef John Mitsuwich. Mr. Mitsuwich, how are you?
Very good. I always feel so much older when you call me by my last name.
Yeah, I know. I had a lot of students that used to do that to me too. It always used to make me feel old. And then they gave me a nickname, and that was so much better because I felt cool and I felt younger.
It wasn't Old Man Scrivani?
No. Definitely wasn't Old Man Scrivani, but it was cute and it was endearing. So for those of you who were my former players and students, you know exactly what we're talking about here. So, John, can you smell that?
What's that?
It's the pumpkin spice in the air, John.
Oh, I thought you were referring to what The Rock was cooking.
No, not The Rock.
I'm still waiting to smell it. I have no idea what he's talking about. It's pumpkin spice. You know what? I don't smell it because whenever I'm about to go past a Starbucks this time of year, I cross to the other side of the street, which is saying something because across the street from the Starbucks where we live is a cabbage factory. But anyway, no, I know where you're going with this. I, too, am not a huge fan of the pumpkin spice that wafts through the air this time of year.
Well, I'm not either. I don't quite understand the whole idea of pumpkin spice. I mean, I understand nutmeg. I understand cinnamon. I understand allspice, but there's no pumpkin in pumpkin spice.
No. Spice is used traditionally to cook with pumpkin, in case anyone out there is confused. And let me go ahead and torpedo this entire segment right now. Because what I like even less than actual pumpkin spice, you know, use it to cook with it. It's fine. Pinch here, but not in every single thing a company serves. The only thing worse than that is now the completely overwrought, overdone criticism of pumpkin spice.
Oh, so we're just being cliche now?
We are beyond that. It's cliche was like 2 years ago. We've transcended cliche to
jumping the shark.
Maybe jumping the shark.
You know the origin of jump the shark?
Yes. I'm insulted by your question.
I had a conversation with somebody who is considerably younger than we are, and they didn't even know what Happy Days was, let alone the Jump the Shark reference.
Yeah, no, it's totally lost on the kids these days. They watch it like, why is he water skiing in a leather jacket? Like, they're worried about other things. But they didn't realize that, yes, that's where the term comes from. The Fonz Fonzarelli actually literally jumped a shark or tried to. I forget if he made it.
He made it, but the show didn't.
Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen that episode yet.
And that is the origin of the story of jumping the shark. Meaning, when you've jumped the shark, it's pretty much all over. So pumpkin spice has jumped the shark.
Exactly. And before we're accused of that, let's go ahead and move on.
But before we do that, we have to do a little bit of housekeeping. As always, we love to hear from you. We want you to interact with us on Twitter and Instagram at Chef John Pod. And we cannot express how much we love your comments and suggestions. So please keep them coming. You can leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice and give us a 5-star rating. Right, John?
That's right. Coincidentally, there's usually 5 spices in pumpkin spice. And we would like the same number of stars when you leave a pumpkin spice seasonally appropriate comment.
And finally, you can leave us a message on our website, thechefjohnpodcast.com, or even better, call us and leave a voicemail and we may feature it on a future show.
If you do leave us a message, make sure you leave your name and where you're from. Otherwise, I will take liberties, many, many liberties.
Unless you're from Northern California.
Then still probably.
Our mailbag is here to respond to messages that you leave us on our website. In this episode, we are going to reach into the mailbag and see what our listeners are asking. We have a message from Scott from Pennsylvania. Scott writes, have you ever tried hog maw? Hog maw is a Pennsylvania Dutch dish that consists of loose sausage, potatoes, celery, carrots, cabbage, seasoning stuffed into a pig's stomach and baked to a deep brown color. Oh my God. John, do you got a recipe for this?
Of course I do. I do it, except I don't use the pig stomach. I use everything else. I call it sausage, potatoes, celery, carrots, and cabbage. And it is delicious. No, I've actually never had this. I've heard of it. I've seen it. I love the name. Don't accidentally put a comma in there. Hog maw. The Pennsylvania Dutch area of Pennsylvania, which is so redundant because it's definitely in Pennsylvania, is really a hotbed for some delicious regional cuisine. I don't know if you've ever been to the area.
I have.
We got Mennonites cooking some delicious things. We got the Amish. We got the Pennsylvania Dutch, which, by the way, have nothing to do with the Dutch. That's Deutsch.
Meaning German.
Apparently, over time, just people are like, screw it, we're going to call him Dutch. I can't be pronouncing Deutsch. Sorry, Danny. So anyway, I've never had hagmah. It sounds delicious. I mean, who doesn't crave, you know, vegetables and sausage stuffed into a pig stomach?
Yeah.
You know, nowadays, if you want to skip the pig stomach and just line your Dutch oven, see, there's a tie-in.
Oh, very nice.
Line your Dutch oven with 6-7 layers of parchment paper, put in all the goodness, wrap it up nice and tight, maybe put a few plates on top to weight it down. You can, notwithstanding the lack of stomach, recreate the dish, all the edible parts. Although that stomach lining that they stuff it in, it really does add flavor. I don't know if you ever had a pâté or even a roast sometimes that's been wrapped in cull fat.
I was thinking of tripe.
It's not dissimilar, but cull fat is that membrane that holds in all the organs. And it's like see-through, clear membrane with white veins of fat. If you've ever bought a real French pâté that had like a kind of a thin coating of fat going around it, that's been wrapped 3 or 4 layers of cull fat. So that's as close as I've ever gotten to tasting this stuff. Definitely had some richness and offal goodness. But anyway, no, sorry, Scott. I've never tried hagmah. But my next trip through Pennsylvania Dutch country, which is in Pennsylvania, I am going to try some hagmah right after I get done with a big old plate of scrapple.
All right. My closest approximation of this dish is a Polish dish called bigos. And the first time I've ever had that, I had to make it for a photo shoot. But then just recently, across the street from my place here in New Jersey, a food truck started appearing. And they come every day and they park the truck in the same place and they serve Polish food. And it's pierogi and it's kielbasa and it's bigos. And basically, bigos is the same thing. And it's sort of gets the same look, that dark, dark brown look with loose pieces of sausage and cabbage and other vegetables. And I can get some right now. I can actually walk out of this podcast and go get some.
Sounds delicious. I think I posted a recipe for bigos. Very delicious stuff. I am a quarter Polish after all.
Well, with a name like Mitsowicz.
It was at least 25% authentic, I believe. Anyway, thanks, Scott. We appreciate it. I just wish you'd asked me about, you know, a cheesesteak. I could give you a little more info, but no, it's very good. Now I'm craving a nice plate of ma. Hog or otherwise. I'll take any ma I can get.
I'm not even going to go there. We're going to introduce a new feature here on the Chef John podcast, and it's called the cocktail story. And this is where John and I tell stories that have to do with cocktails. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we were stumbling around drunk somewhere, although that could be the case. But it is really more about the connection of beverages to our daily life, just like food is a connection on our daily lives. So we wanted to bring a little bit more of the imbibement into the show. So John, tell me a story.
About cocktails?
Yes.
Okay. Well, this was a little bit of a challenge for me when you brought up this new feature in one of our many pre-production meetings. Because as you know, I'm a beer guy. I'm not a cocktail menu guy. And if I do have a cocktail, what I do is I read over all the signature cocktails. What do they call them these days? The artisan, the handcrafted, and I love the term, I see it on the menu, the handcrafted cocktail, because there's nothing worse than walking into a bar and some robot or machine makes your cocktail. I hate that. So anyway, I don't have a ton of cocktail related stories, although what you said when you introed this, it could be about us stumbling around drunk. I got lots of those stories, but I'm going to stick to the, what is it called? The brief.
Yes.
I do have a story involving a famous cocktail known as the margarita that I'm sure many of our listeners in the audience are familiar with. And I still chuckle to this day, even though it happened like, you know, 50 years ago. So when I was in college, culinary school at Paul Smith's, the nearest actual town city was called Saranac Lake, New York. And I worked at a hotel there, the Hotel Saranac. And my other job to pay my way was at a Mexican restaurant called Casa del Sol, which of course in Spanish means Casa of Sol. And I was a cook, line cook, prep cook, great restaurant, great chef. Chef traveled through Mexico, learned all a bunch of legit recipes. And so I learned a ton, but the restaurant is well known for their margaritas as their food. They had the most famous margarita in the area. People drove an hour to get this margarita. And it, over the years, had built up this, you know, mythology about just how amazing this margarita was. And the owner of the restaurant, Harry, would make a big show out of the fact that he was so closely guarding the secret to this recipe, to this mix that he mixed with the tequila, that he would not do it at the restaurant. He would only do it at his house, which was directly across the street from the restaurant. So what would happen a couple times a night, one of the bartenders, Harry, get low and sour, Mick. And he would be like, all right, be right back. And he would leave the place. He always sat at the end of the bar, just like on Norman Cheers. He always had the one seat at the end, hung out there sipping on probably a margarita until he was needed. And then they would yell, get low on margarita. And he would walk across the street and everyone would have to wait. The bartender, what I found out later, would pretend they were out 5 minutes, everyone hang tight. And Harry would walk across the street. And very dramatically, about 5-10 minutes later, come back across the street with a 5-gallon bucket of his freshly mixed margarita mixture, sour mix, lemon, lime, whatever secret ingredients. Nobody knew, not even his wife. The legend of this thing was out of control. So, you know, they say he has a witch locked in his cell. You know, there was like, you know, it was crazy. And the people waiting for their margarita would watch this. It was like so much more exciting because, oh my God, they ran out when I ordered mine. And Harry had to go across this. Come to find out, maybe a year later from the chef, Harry had no secret margarita mix recipe. He just walked over to his house, opened up a few jugs of your standard off the shelf, food and beverage, disco truck that drives up. I don't know if it was powdered or concentrate. Clearly not homemade, no fresh lemon or lime. Although I take that back. He used to slice a few limes just to look like somebody had, like the New York lemon ice vendors, they put a few seeds in.
Yeah.
I thought that was the funniest thing because it was such opposite of what the myth was in the legend, but nobody cared. Customers loved the act. Twice a night, you have to wait for Harry to go over and from scratch mix up this mix and everyone had to wait. Everyone would clap when he came back. Harry, woo! Harry, Harry, Harry. And so he just played that, you know, to the max. The bartenders loved it. The help, even the ones that know the secret, loved it. The customers, of course, loved it because who doesn't love a nice, you know, handcrafted margarita mix? At an early age, young cook, I was like learning these extra lessons regarding the power of suggestion. If you tell someone they're going to have the best margarita they've ever had in their lives, and there's a line at the place to get a margarita, and then they have to wait while the guy goes across the street to make the, you know, it all builds in your mind and then you drink it. It doesn't matter what it tastes like. You're thinking, oh man, this is good. Is this good? This is good, right? So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I learned about that power suggestion and just, you have to have some kind of legend and myth about a secret recipe or a secret technique. It just makes it all more delicious and it makes it more fun for everybody involved, even if it's a total lie.
You're basically describing what Instagram has done for restaurants. Seriously, I would walk from my home in the Lower East Side to my studio in the East Village every morning. And there was a pancake shop, you know, like a diner kind of place that got featured on the Food Network. And as soon as they got featured on the Food Network, there was a line out the door every day. And it was just a pancake. It wasn't anything fantastic. But, you know, there was this thing about how it was this great recipe and it was just special thing and blah, 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 similar to what you're talking about. And then every morning I'd walk by and under my breath, I would make a sound of like sheep. And my wife would give me the elbow. She's like, stop doing that. Stop doing that.
I remember when the Cronut hit the scene.
The Cronut, right. That's like Carnival Barker, con man kind of stuff.
Oh, yes. Yes.
That's perfect.
E.T. Barnum would have been promoted.
Well, John, I have a story too, and it's bordering on scandalous. So when I was a boy, my dad and I would watch boxing. Because at the time, the welterweight division was filled with all these big superstars, you know, Sugar Ray Leonard and Roberto Duran and Marvin Hagler and Tommy Hearns and all these great guys. And my dad met a few of them and he met Mustafa Hamsho in Brooklyn one time. So we were big fans of all things the welterweight division in boxing. And my dad worked nights. So there was this big fight that was happening. It was Hagler Hearns. I don't remember which one because I know they fought a couple of times. So it was Tommy Hearns and Marvin Hagler and they were fighting. And I was like 14 or 15 years old and I had to see this fight. And the only place you could see it was at a bar. And of course, you know, back then the rules were a little bit loose and you could only watch it on closed circuit television. So there was this bar that was going to play the fight on these big screens or whatever. So it was about a mile and a half, maybe 2 miles from where I lived. So I walked there by myself and I got up to the door. the bouncer was there. I'd never been to a bar before. I didn't know that there was a cover charge or whatever, but I had some money with me. So the guy looks at me. He's like, what are you here for? I'm like, I'm here to see the fight. He's like, okay, it's $20 or whatever. So I give him the money. I go in the bar. And clearly I'm the youngest person in this bar by a lot. I've never ordered a drink before in a bar. And like, I've had drinks before, you know, like just hanging out in the schoolyard drinking beer or blackberry brandy with my friends. But I never had a drink in a bar. I didn't know what to order. So I'm standing next to this guy at the bar, you know, the fight's starting to go on. And he looks at the bartender and he goes, oh yeah, give me an Alabama Slammer. So I'm like, yeah, I'll take one too. And the guy brings me this drink and I taste it. And I'm like, wow, this is like Hawaiian punch. This is amazing. It's so nice. So I drink one, I drink another, I drink a third, and I am lit. I mean, if you know what's in an Alabama Slammer, you realize that basically there's very little anything that resembles juice. It's pretty much all alcohol. And I was hammered. And I'm watching the fight, and I'm all excited, and I'm enjoying it, and I'm there. And all of a sudden, it's like the fight's over, and I got to go home. And I'm completely drunk, but I'm energized. And I remember running home. Because I'm thinking like, oh my God, I've been out all night. My parents are going to kill me. They don't know where I am and blah, blah, blah. And I run home and I get in bed and I'm laying there and I get the spins. I'm like, oh, what's this? This is new. I don't think I've ever had an Alabama Slammer again from that point on. The next morning I woke up, I felt like I got run over by a truck. But it was one of those things connected to like a sporting event or something that was important and fun. So that was my first drink in a bar. So that's my story.
There's certain drinks you don't even have to look up the ingredients. You just go by the name. Like, hey, do you want an Alabama Slammer? Like, absolutely not.
No.
Is that named after a prison? It's like, you don't even want to know what's in it. But yeah, I think that's the Long Island iced tea of the Deep South.
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't taste like it, but it's 90% alcohol.
Yeah.
You remember that first room spinning and then the first hangover. And then you're like, wait, why did I do that for? And then for some reason, you know, you do it again later. Anyway. Good cocktail story.
And that brings us to pairings, John, our favorite segment here on the Chef John podcast, where we talk about what we're watching and what it makes us want to eat. I'm going to go first this week because I'm so excited to talk about this show. I watch my TV through Apple TV and, you know, they make all these suggestions and usually they make suggestions from their own platform. And I've been seeing this show pop up on my suggested list for like the last couple of months. I had no idea what it was. I didn't read any reviews. I saw nothing about it in media. I kind of went into it completely blind. I was like, you know what? They've been suggesting this show to me. It's got Emmy nominations. Let me watch it. So I start watching Severance on Apple TV Plus. And it is delightfully strange. Set design is beautiful. And the actors in it have almost this tiny little twist of odd. And I'll tell you, like, for example, the four main players on the show are Adam Scott, Patricia Arquette, John Turturro, and of course, Christopher Walken. So if we're starting there, you already know that the show is going to be a little bit offbeat. It obviously has a science fiction tilt to it, and I'll explain why. So basically, the show is about this group of workers who work for this sort of evil corp kind of thing, you know, where there's this big corporation and it's, you know, kind of all encompassing. You don't really know what they do kind of thing called Lumen. And Lumen has developed a technology for some of their workers called Severance. So basically what this is they implant a chip in the brain of the worker. And then when the worker goes into work, they descend into the basement of this very modern building and their consciousness bifurcates. So the person they are on the outside and the person they are inside do not know each other and they don't know what each other does. So basically it's as if you never leave work or as if you never go to work. So your whole consciousness has been bifurcated. And people do this for different reasons, and you learn a lot about the people. But you also start to learn that maybe this isn't in the best interest of all the people. And what are they going to do about it? And it's really fascinating and interesting. And it's a very creative metaphor about the work-life balance and the fact that we have this struggle between who we are as people on outside and who we are when we do our jobs. So Severance is a fascinating show. And honestly, it's brilliant. It's directed by Ben Stiller, and it's not really funny. So I think from that perspective, you know, somebody who's as regarded as a comedian as Ben Stiller taking on a project like this that has much more serious undertones is really interesting as well. So I can't tell you how much I recommend this show. I really think it's fascinating and wonderful, and you should definitely watch it. And what it makes me want to eat, John, is part of the work segment of Severance. They get these kind of strange perks and rewards that are very childlike when they do good work. So like if they meet quotas or they do something special, they get little prizes. And one of the prizes is waffles. A waffle party is the biggest thing they can get. So of course, at the first mention of waffles, all I could think about is waffles. Now, every time I watch the show, all I think about is waffles because I love waffles and I love them every which way. I can eat them with ice cream. I can eat them with jam. I can eat them with powdered sugar. I can eat them with syrup. I love waffles. So you should do the same. You should watch the show and go have a waffle.
That sounds delicious. I've never heard of the show, to be quite frank. I've barely heard of Apple TV. I know it's a thing.
It is.
And my, of course, benevolent overlord, YouTube, also, I think, has a similar service. Don't they have like a TV streaming?
They do.
So I'm you know, I always do this as not so much a bit, but it's become like a shtick. I don't know anything about the new technology for getting all these great new latest, greatest shows, but I'm getting there.
You don't have a smart TV?
I do, but I choose not to use the apps. So yeah, Severance, I'm not going to watch anytime soon. Although once every single one of these streaming services are all been, you know, homogenized into one app, which is probably only a matter of time, then I'll be able to see all these shows. So Severance sounds interesting. I love the premise. I do enjoy a waffle when I can get one, but a shameful admission, and it's so shameful, I'm going to speak in the third person. Chef John does not have a waffle iron.
What?
Whenever I get a request for a waffle recipe or try this or try that, I'm always like, oh, I'd love to. No waffle iron. Now, of course, the joke is it just would take me one email to the corporate overlords who, as you know, are benevolent and generous. And they would send me a waffle iron and I could do a video. I don't know. I'm afraid to commit to a waffle iron.
We have to basically get you to make a whole week's worth of waffle recipes.
All waffles all the time.
All waffles all the time. It's got to be like a backlog, right? Because you've been doing recipes for what, 15 years now?
2,000 videos to my credit. Zero waffle recipes.
All right, we got to get you a waffle iron so that you can just do nothing but waffle recipes for like 3 months.
Anyway, no waffle maker. So I could not experience your pairing or your show. But other than that, sounds amazing. Now, we've already talked. You are a fan of the chicken waffle.
Yes.
Okay. I was intrigued by the actual literal chicken waffle. People are making waffles out of chicken breasts they pound out.
Ooh.
And then batter and then smush in the iron. And it looks like a waffle, but it's actually a breaded piece of chicken. Cut out the middleman. You just go chicken waffle right there, one piece.
That's genius.
Yeah. When and if I am able to, I will check out Severance. I like those kind of shows with a, it sounds like there's a little bit of dark humor in there.
A little bit.
And speaking of dark, my pairing this episode is The Sandman on Netflix. Which, I don't know if you're familiar with it.
No, but it sounds scary.
Apparently a famous comic book, and you know I'm a huge fan of the genre. Not at all. But this is a big popular show on Netflix. The Sandman is Morpheus. He's one of the Endless. He's Dream. And then the other ones, I forget all the names. There's Despair, Destiny.
Destiny's Child.
Destiny's Child, that's the kid. But anyway, The Sandman, Morpheus, the Dream, or Dream, don't call him the Dream, it's like Dream, he gets captured like 100 years ago, and basically dreaming stops, and people that were dreaming when that happened stayed asleep. They called it the sleeping sickness.
Wow.
So that's how the show starts, and then I don't want to spoil anything, but it takes him 100 years or so, but he finally escapes, and his empire, his realm, I guess is the right term, the realm of dreams has collapsed. It's just fallen into disrepair and he needs to bring it back. And anyway, that's the show. I didn't like it.
Oh, but why are you recommending it?
That's a good question. I haven't seen anything else lately. It's the first reason. But no, Michelle really liked it and it did grow on me as I watched.
Okay.
Because I wanted to hate everything about it because it is a comic book inspired, or I don't know if it's a graphic novel or comic. You know the difference between a comic book and a graphic novel, don't you?
Binder.
About $26. So anyway, I'm not sure exactly the origin, But great special effects. If you're into that kind of fantasy movie, like way out there fantasy movie, it is very entertaining. Like the characters don't fit what you'd imagine like a devil to be or destiny to be or dream. Like it's just, it's really out there. And, you know, subplots with the humans involved and people trying to go in and out of dreams to accomplish things. So it was interesting. I don't generally enjoy series like that. And ironically, I did fall asleep a few times during a couple of the episodes. Speaking of Sandman. But interesting premise. Probably worth watching if you're if you got Netflix and you want something just way, way out there. Now, again, you know, the reason I don't like some of these fantasy movies is because you're able to do anything at any time with any character for any reason. And it's totally cool because we said they're allowed to do that. So that always gets me a little bit. I'm like, oh my God, how are they going to get out of this? Oh, all they had to do was grab that ruby and rub the ruby. That was easy. So there's a little bit of a, you know, it can be anticlimactic at some points with these fantasy movies and series, but entertaining, well done, lots of action. And if you do like that genre, I'm assuming you would love it. People seem to love it. And it's been really popular on Netflix, which, you know, take that with a grain of salt. Some of the things that are popular, I'm like, what? Why is this on here?
I like that you're thinking about the rest of us, John. It's very unselfish of you.
Now, I will admit the other big reason I picked Sandman, even though it's not my cup of chamomile tea, is because of the pairing. I'm going to go with a cheddar spinach omelet because they've done studies and there's been anecdotal evidence and ancient evidence that eating cheese, cheddar in particular, and things with lots of vitamin B and tryptophan will actually induce lucid / vivid dreaming. Apparently, you know, that thing where you eat a big meal before bed, you can have a nightmare or a dream. That's like a real thing. So there's people that actually will eat like specific foods, cheddar, like I said, the foods rich in vitamin B, so that they have a better chance at having one of these lucid dreams. When I started researching foods that make you dream, because that's obviously the theme of the show, lots of interesting info, but vitamin B and tryptophan were a couple of the common denominators of people that were trying to eat things to make this happen. So I'm going to pair Sandman that might actually put you to sleep without the omelet, but definitely with the omelet and the Sandman, you could be on your way to a very lucid, vivid dream.
John, you're solving all kinds of problems for us, solving insomnia, you're giving us entertainment, food. We got everything. We both went breakfast food this time. I mean, not all waffle recipes are breakfast food and you can eat eggs at night, but we both went breakfast today. That's not bad.
Yeah. No, times are tough.
But I may give it a shot. I saw it advertised on Netflix the other day and it popped up on my suggested list. So I might get it because, you know, I'm into sci-fi fantasy and it sounds a lot like that. And there's some Greek mythology mixed in there, which I also like. So I'll go for it.
And the star, Tom Sturridge.
Yep. I know the name. Yeah, sure.
Actually was in not a major part, but had an interesting part in another show I recommended, Irma Vep. He was a former boyfriend of hers and so forth. So anyway, I knew I recognized him and he kind of looks like he was like third or fourth choice for one of the, what was the werewolf versus vampire movie series?
Oh, the Twilight series.
Well, yeah, he looks like like poor man's Twilight guys. So he has look. Hopefully, I'm pretty sure he's not listening to this. If he is, no offense, but I generally don't go for the, is his hair like that on purpose or not? Kind of actors, but he did a great job in this and was perfectly cast, I think, as Morpheus.
All right. And I'm really excited for our top five this week, John, because we are just entering into territory because we are starting to get chilly out there. The fall is here. And what does that mean? It means it's time to make some cookies. So, John, our top five this week is your top five cookies.
And I am a pretty big fan of cookies. I don't like a lot of desserts. We've talked about candy, kind of take it or leave it, but a cookie, I always appreciate a nice cookie. So for my top five, we're going to go with number five, Pfeffernusse.
What?
Or is it Pfeffernuss?
Pfeffernugen? What?
No. It means German for peppernut.
Oh, okay.
And it is a very aggressively spiced cookie. By the way, fun fact, originally there was no pepper in it. Did you know that way back in the day, pepper was just sort of a generic term for spices?
Really?
Yeah, the pepper came from the spice roads. And so that they put all these ingredients in the cookie, it was just known as pepper, like ginger, cinnamon, so forth, nutmeg.
You mean pumpkin spice?
Yes, very similar.
Oh, okay.
So if you want to do a pumpkin spice pfeffernusse, you could do that. But what's so interesting about this cookie, it is fat-free, but not on purpose. It doesn't need fat.
How does that work?
It's sugar, it's starch, it's other goodness mixed up. And it cooks up with a really interesting texture. The inside's kind of soft and chewy and cake-like. And then the outside has that baked, really thin, crackly crust you get with like a sugar finish. And they're a traditional Christmas cookie. I made a bunch last holidays and gave them to the neighbor and so forth. But really delicious, really spicy, and just a beautiful sort of one bite popper size. They're the size of a nut, which is where the nut part of the name comes from. So it's spices, nut. They're shaped like a small little, like half a walnut. And if you've never heard of a pfeffernusse, you got to make it because it is delicious and makes a great holiday treat, which brings us to number four. Chewy style, spicy, extra spicy ginger snaps. And I like an actual literal ginger snap, which I guess technically to be a ginger snap, it has to snap when you break it. So I'm technically incorrect here.
The ginger bend.
The ginger fold. But I really love a beautiful, chewy, super spicy ginger snap.
So far, both of your cookies have been spicy cookies.
Yes. The first two cookies are almost identical, although ginger snaps do have butter in them, like all normal cookies should and do. But I'll take a ginger snap anytime. Love a ginger snap. If it's crispy, I'm fine. I'm not going to give it back to you. But I do like the chewy style. We do have to come up with a name for it. So if you are super bored and you're on our social media and you can't think of what to ask us or tell us, please let us know, what should a non-crispy ginger snap be called? That brings us to number three, a classic Toll House chocolate chip cookie with walnuts. Now, I like a good chocolate chip cookie. I'll take a plain one, but there's something about when there's walnuts in it. And that's how, for whatever reason, my mom usually made chocolate chip cookies, or they would do half a batch plain, half a batch walnuts. And I would always exclusively go for the walnut batch. So that was sort of a childhood memory cookie. For whatever reason, I remember freshly made, still warm chocolate chip cookies with walnuts. Love that. Eat it anytime. Which brings us to number two, jam-filled thumbprint cookies, which also, like my first two cookies were similar in spicing, this cookie also features walnuts that are finely chopped up, mixed into basically a shortbread style dough, crumbly, brittle, buttery. And then you make a ball, you bake them, and you push your thumb down, and the thumb print gets filled with the jam of your choice. So once it's done, you have a beautiful, buttery, shortbread style cookie with walnuts, and then that sticky, sweet and tart jam. Beautiful combination. Another one of my mom, Polly Mitsuwich's famous cookies. And then we're going with a little bit of a surprise here. And I know you're like, I've been surprised with your whole list. Number one, a white chocolate macadamia. Now, let me tell you why this one's on here. If you're putting together the Chef John trivia board game, please pay attention. When I got to San Francisco, I worked at the San Francisco Opera House. And then that was just a 3-month job. And I was out of work, didn't want to go home because I'm in San Francisco. Why would I go back to Shortsville, New York? So I'm biding my time. I'm trying to find some other gig until the next opera season or until I can find a real chef job. And I stumble into this cookie store on Fisherman's Wharf called Blue Chip Cookies. They were at one time a fairly popular chain franchise right after Mrs. Fields. In fact, off the record, I think the owner of this cookie store I worked at did an apprenticeship with a Mrs. Fields and tried to steal the recipe. Don't think they did, but they got a few ideas. Anyway, this was their signature cookie that would set them apart from Mrs. Fields, who was doing the chocolate chips. This was a white chocolate chunk, not chips, chunk, which was very, cutting edge back then. Very irregular chunks with half macadamia nuts. I think they lost money on this cookie because there was like a lot of macadamias, and those are about $30 a pound, literally. And I'm not a big white chocolate guy, but there's something about white chocolate and macadamia that is so perfect together. You have to taste it to experience what I'm saying. And that was an amazing cookie. And I actually worked there for about 6 months. I quickly went from cookie scooper to assistant manager, not to brag. And the white chocolate macadamia was the king of our cookie selection. And of course, now today, I probably can't even eat one because I smelled them and ate so many back then that I think I lost the magic. But that was always, for many, many years, my ideal of just the ultimate cookie.
Let me get back into this list, John, because your Pfeffernuggen cookies. But yeah, Pfeffernusse. Yeah, no, forget it. Cookies got to be sweet, man.
No, this is sweet. This is very sweet. It's ginger. It's cinnamon. It's nutmeg.
All right. Spicy. I'll try it.
Well, it's funny. See, now that you know this word exists, you will notice, I guarantee, around Christmas time, anytime you're in a foodie scenario, shop area, food court, you will now notice boxes of Pfeffernusse. It's huge around the holidays, but it's not something I didn't even really notice until I made the recipe, started researching it. These are everywhere. They're ubiquitous around the holidays in just like regular grocery stores. Like, you know how they have the end cap with the Italian Christmas bread?
Panettone.
Yeah, all the holiday baked goods you only see for 1 month a year.
Right.
Pfeffernusse will be on that table.
Okay. I'll make sure I get some of those with the Boston baked beans candy.
Yes. Oh my God. That's a pairing.
Well, number four for you, John, chewy, spicy ginger snaps. I am not necessarily a ginger snap guy, but I love a chewy cookie. So if you make them, I'd eat them because I know they'll probably be outstanding. So I will indulge in that as well. But once we get to number three, John, you're going to have to make extra.
Okay.
Because I absolutely love the classic Toll House chocolate chip cookies, and nothing makes a chocolate chip cookie better than some nuts. I had something like this on my list, but I modified my list a little bit because I have so many cookies that I love. And I saw that you were going to do this cookie, and I'm just piggybacking. So this is John's three, and it's definitely like in my list somewhere, just not stated, because I love a classic Toll House cookie. Jam-filled thumbprint cookies. You know, growing up in an Italian household, there were lots of these jam-filled cookies that we would get. And they're very similar in that it would be like a little hole in the middle of them, fill them up with jam. A lot of times I found them to be kind of cakey and dry. So I'm not necessarily saying no to your jam-filled cookie, but texture matters to me. I don't like a dry cookie. I don't like a cookie that just falls apart when I bite into it. So can you give me a little context on your cookie?
It's about half butter. So while texture for sure crumbly, dry, no, definitely not dry.
Okay. Sense of cookie tasting coming up.
Yeah.
And your number one, John, I love this cookie. You know what is funny it reminds me of is like, you know, when you go to like a conference of some kind at like a big hotel or something and they put out the cookie plate, there always seems to be these gigantic macadamia nut cookies in there. And they're always the best ones and the ones that people take right away. Those and the chocolate chips. I love that cookie. That's a great cookie. It's so rich though. My God, it's almost greasy with fat. So good.
Yes. That's a good call. These ones we made a blue chip cookie. Like if you crushed one in your hand, like butter would come out between your fingers.
I have a feeling I might have got one of those cookies from you personally when we were children, because I was wandering around down in Fisherman's Wharf with my uncle when I was a kid.
You probably had one.
All right. Well, John, that's a great list. It's a little bit offbeat, but then again, this is the Chef John podcast. So what do you come to expect from Chef John? It's got to be a little foodie and it's going to be a little weird. Mine might be a little bit more traditional, but we'll see. Let's get into my list, John.
Do it.
All right. At number five, peanut butter cookies, because of course, peanut butter. All things for me lead back to peanut butter, just like all things for John lead back to mashed potatoes. I'm surprised we did not have a mashed potato cookie in here.
I tried.
We got to try that.
I searched.
Peanut butter cookies, man. Woo, that and a glass of milk. You can't go wrong. I love it. So good. And if you want to dip half of it in chocolate, it's going to be pretty good. And again, that texture on a good peanut butter cookie is like that of the macadamia cookie. It's got that bendy, chewy, just delicious, fatty goodness.
You should be able to set a decent peanut butter cookie on fire.
Because it's got so much fat in it?
Yes.
All right. So number four cookie for me, Ricciarelli, a chewy Italian almond cookie. Now, I love these cookies. They're like, again, sort of like the size of a half dollar. And they're a little puffy and crackly on top. And when you bite into them, like any good almond cookie will have that chewy texture where it's crispy on the outside and chewy in the middle and dusted with some powdered sugar. Love this cookie. Get them at the holidays quite often at the Italian bakeries in and around New York. I absolutely want one of these cookies right now. I'm craving an almond cookie. And of course, as somebody who tries not to eat a lot of wheat, and you'll see there's a little bit of a theme in some of my things here, almond paste or marzipan cookies have a tendency to be a little easier on my system. So they are the cookies I have gravitated to in my older adult life. Adults need cookies too. So at number three, rainbow cookies. Now, those Italian rainbow cookies are also made with almond flour, and they are the three colors of the Italian flag with the jam in the middle, and they're dipped in chocolate. Absolutely delicious. And I have a special relationship with the rainbow cookie because a film that we produced a couple of years ago called Team Marco, which I might have mentioned here before, the rainbow cookies play a pivotal role in the film. So if you're interested in watching that movie, I can recommend getting yourself some rainbow cookies because they're going to make you hungry when you see them. And even in the opening credits, you will see photographs of rainbow cookies that I took. Number two, we are sticking with the almond flour presentation, macarons. Now, macarons, not to be confused with macaroons, which is a coconut cookie, which I also love. But these are those little Oreo-looking sandwich cookies that have like all different colors and they're filled with different kinds of flavors, like a little bit of chocolate, a little bit of pistachio, a little bit of jam. They're delicious. They come like pink and green, and you see them in the French bakeries. I love these cookies, again, because I can eat them, and they're light, and they're chewy. There's definitely a theme going here, and I really, really enjoy a macaron. That brings us to number one. John, you're going to be surprised at this one. Because you know what? You can only get these at a specific time of year. You can't even get them year-round, which is why it builds up the great desire for Malomars. Now, if you don't know what a Malomar is, a Malomar is a graham cracker cookie with marshmallow and dipped in chocolate. So basically, it's like a s'more in a cookie form. A Malomar is my father's absolute favorite cookie. He loves it, and he can't wait till they come out in the fall. Now, my dad shouldn't be eating Malomars at this point. But many years ago, my dad was ill, and he recovered, and he's doing much better. But he missed Christmas dinner one year because he was in the hospital. And we bought Malomars, and we basically just stacked them up on his plate. And we were like, well, when dad comes home, this is all he's going to want to eat. So we're going to give him the plate of Malomars. We always had them in the house as kids. My dad loved them. And whenever they come out in the fall, you know, they melt really easily because the thin layer of chocolate over the top. And man, the Malomar, if you've never had one, you're missing out.
Very impressive list. Zero surprise with the peanut butter cookies. One of my favorite also that could have easily made my list. And I don't know, it almost rivals a chocolate chip as far as its affinity with milk. It is the perfect dip in milk, drink with milk, eat with milk cookie. It's just something about it.
Drink it, eat it, whatever you want to do.
Drink it, eat it, absorb it through your skin. But yeah, love a peanut butter cookie. Now, these chewy Italian almond cookies you speak of.
Yes.
Are these similar to the classic, like Amaretti Originale?
Yeah, except the Amaretti are a little crunchier. These are a little chewier, which is what separates them from the Amaretti.
And the only reason I ask, because I've always found it so fascinating, there's no almond in that cookie.
Right.
It's actually apricot, or what they call it, bitter almond. I don't know. But anyway, it's not actually like people think almond meal or ground almond flour, which is weird because it tastes exactly like almond. And there's no almond. So, rainbow cookies, I remember from your movie screening in Marin. We got to go see Andrew's movie premiere in Marin. Was it the Mill Valley Film Festival? I believe, if not mistaken, it won the Audience Choice Award.
It did.
Congrats again on that. And the rainbow cookie was featured in that. And ever since seeing it there, I'm like, I really would like one of those rainbow cookies. I've never had one.
What? How is that even possible?
Because I only went to New York 1 week a year, and there was only so many things we could stuff in our faces.
Oh, I have so many things to bring to California.
And we never spent a ton of time in Staten Island, which I think is the ground zero for the rainbow cookie.
It is indeed.
So one of these days, it would make a fun video. Maybe one of these days I'll film it. Macaron, not to be confused with macaroon, which is the hardest part of that discussion at a cocktail party. People think, you mean the one with the coconut you dip in it? No, not the macaron. You mean the president of France? No, the cookie macaron. That is a funny cookie for a food blogger to talk about, because that was maybe, and someone will correct me, but that was the first most viral sweet, I'll say, I'll separate from savory, that swept food blogger realm. everyone was making macarons. Everyone was trying to make them. Very few people did it successfully because they're a very tricky cookie to nail. To get the feet, you got to get the feet. Oh, the feet. And if you're wondering what I'm talking about feet, go watch our chocolate macaron video. It actually came out pretty good. But hard to make, amazing to eat. If done correctly, one of the great cookie experiences. Incredible texture. You can fill them with a million different things, flavor them a million different ways. So that is a magnificent cookie. And then the Malamar, I am familiar with. Let's see, do I want to compare it to the Campfire Classic s'more? You have to work not to say some more.
Can I have some more s'mores?
Oh, I love those s'mores. I had no idea, which sounds like a stupid business model. Why are they only available in the fall?
It has to do with the shelf life. You can't really transport them in very warm weather because they'll melt. Either that, or they just do it for that kind of novelty, similar to your margarita guy.
Yeah, you really, it's so hard to get. You need to get it. Interesting. Yeah. So I'm not a huge s'more fan. So I'm not sure I'm a big Malamar fan. But now that I know I can only get them a certain time of the year, I kind of want one.
Now you got to get it.
It worked. Darn it. But anyway, I love your list. I would love all those cookies probably, except for maybe Malamar. Depends on what season. I would hate to enjoy that off season.
So at the end of every show, we like to have a segment called A Peek Behind the Curtain, where John and I talk about our experiences in food behind the camera. So, John, give us a peek behind the curtain.
Hold on, let me pull it back. Well, today, my peek behind the curtain, it's a little bit of a sad one. I know we like to keep things light here on the Chef John podcast. Do a lot of joking around and shenanigans and you name it. We do it here. But it's always fun. It's always frivolous. So I always feel weird when I talk about something serious and maybe not 100% happiness. But when you do what we do for a living, you almost never get to actually enjoy the food that's the subject of your shoot or your video or your TV commercial or whatever it is. It might start out good and you're like, man, that's a good looking steak. But by the time you're done touching it and filming it and moving it and doing everything you do to produce one of these videos, the last thing I want to do is eat the thing I'm shooting. So it's always such a weird disconnect between this hopefully gorgeous looking plate of food, looks good, smells good, great ingredients. And you turn off the camera and it's the last thing in the world you want to eat or enjoy. So that is probably the ultimate peek behind the curtain for doing this job that people might not even consider. By the time you're done working with something for 6-7 hours, and then you've talked about it in a voiceover, it loses all its magic. That's why things taste so much better when someone else cooks it for you.
It's so true.
It doesn't matter what it is. It could be a bag of popcorn. It just tastes better if you don't have to make it. So this is that taken to, you know, the nth degree. So that is my peek behind the curtain. Anything you see me eating, pretending to enjoy in a video, I'm just simulating enjoying it.
You're acting. You're an actor, John.
I'm an actor because the person that didn't spend all day making this and working all week on it will enjoy it. So I think I mean truthful in the final payoff, but it's almost virtually impossible to enjoy something you've filmed and photographed and cooked and touched all day and then sit down and actually enjoy it for its own standalone experience. It just doesn't work out.
I think my experience is very similar. It's a little different when you do stills because quite often you'll shoot something and you want to get a shot of it really quick and then it's still hot or it's still sitting there and maybe you eat it for lunch. But that experience of working with something all day long and not really wanting to be engaged with it afterwards is very common. Now, the food is still edible and people ask me that all the time. Oh, is it real food? Can you eat it? Whatever. And of course, yes, the answer is yes. But the experience of the food is not the same for sure. And then I also enjoy the idea that I could pack the food up quite often and give it to other people, which is nice. So I'm with you. I can't tell you how many times I worked with food all day long in the studio and then go out to dinner on the way home. That whole experience of it tastes better when someone else cooks it is a real thing. So my peek behind the curtain is similarly not all that fun, John. I don't think we discussed this at the pre-production meeting, but what I really don't enjoy doing after being in this business for 20 years is I don't take pictures of my food like that I'm eating, like at a restaurant. I just don't do it. And there's a couple of reasons why. One is when something is your job, it's different when you're in your day-to-day life trying to sort of live outside of work and have separation between your work and your life. And food obviously can't be separated because you have to eat to live, and we enjoy eating and we really like the rituals of food. But taking pictures of my food is my job. And people get kind of surprised sometimes when they're at a restaurant with me or we're out at some food event or something, and I'm not really that interested in taking pictures of food. And it's not because I don't love to take pictures of food. And quite often, if something is really beautiful and it catches my eye, I, of course, as a photographer, want to take a picture of it. But the need to document everything that I eat is not an instinct that I have. And it, honestly, it's just a function of, you know, if you're doing any job, when you're on your time off, you don't necessarily want to do your job. You know, like I just heard Derek Jeter talk about this on that documentary they did about him. And then he was speaking about it on TV the other night, is he and Alex Rodriguez were having a conversation, which is news in and of itself. But Derek Jeter was saying that when they would go out to dinner when they were younger, Alex would not stop talking about baseball. And Derek was saying, I don't even watch baseball when I leave the stadium. He's like, the last thing I want to do is talk about baseball, watch baseball. And it's the same thing. It's like, you just need some separation. So that might be a bit of a surprise for people, a little bit of peek behind my curtain, but I don't really love taking pictures of food when I'm not working.
You just reminded me, I always feel bad meeting peers when I used to do the events. I watch nothing else on YouTube. And it's just, it's like hundreds of insanely talented peers of mine that should be watched. When I'm done, I'm done. And I have zero interest in watching people cook online. I barely want to watch my thing by the time I'm done with it. So yeah, I can totally relate to that.
So we were a little bit of Debbie Downers today, John.
That's right. Well, you know, it's perfect at the end of the show. That's when you want to let people down.
We got to keep it real with the Chef John podcast. We bring it full circle here at the Chef John podcast. And at the end of every show, we love to know what we learned. So, John, what did we learn today?
Well, the first thing we learned, which I think is really valuable if we have any 19, 20-year-olds in the audience, if you're looking for the perfect first drink, the perfect cocktail to start your drinking journey in life, you can't go wrong with the Alabama Slammer.
It's the full experience.
Three or four of those, there's a pretty good chance you might not drink again. So you might be doing yourself a big favor after the room stops spinning and you get over that just epic hangover. You might just go right to, I don't know, iced tea and fruit juice and just skip the whole cocktail culture. So Alabama Slammer, fantastic first drink. One thing I learned, which I still find shocking, that if you are a fan of the Malamars, you can't get those all year. It's only in the fall. They're seasonal. Apparently, it has something to do with temperature-controlled shipping because nobody, and I mean nobody, wants a melty Malamars. That would be a melty Mar, which is not the same thing.
Or a s'more.
Yes, or s'more. So a Malamar, if you're hoping for one right now, you're in luck. If you want one late spring, early summer, too bad.
Not so much.
You'll have to settle for a jam-filled thumbprint or something. And then last but not least, I think we learned that if you love food and you want to really, really enjoy that meal you're working so hard on, do not under any circumstances try to make it into a recipe video for YouTube, because by the time you're done, it is not going to taste as good and you will not enjoy it as much. So I think the takeaway here is, if at all possible, have other people cook for you.
I think that is a very clever way to stiff arm the competition, John.
That's right. And also, if I don't know of your amazing video, do not take it personally. I'm not into the busman's holidays, as they say. And I always wondered where that started. Did a busman literally take like a bus trip and people are like, what are you doing? Why would you want a bus trip for your vacation? You drive a bus all week. Anyway.
Well, maybe somebody can tell us about that on Twitter.
That's right. All right. Anyway, we learned plenty. That's the point. So thank you for listening and learning, or not. But definitely thank you for listening, supporting the show. Give us some feedback online. Leave us a message. Leave us a voicemail. And I think that's it. So that leaves just one last thing to do. And that is say goodnight, Andrew.
Goodnight, Andrew.